Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Wolford v. Lopez, docket number 24-1046, decided June 25, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. For years, Hawaii made it almost impossible to obtain a license to carry a firearm, and after this, court held in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin that the Second and Fourteenth Amendments protect the right to carry handguns outside the home for self-defense. Hawaii replaced its old carry permit law with new laws that achieved a similar result. At issue here is a Hawaii law that prohibits firearms on private property, open to the public without the express and affirmative consent of the property owner. Three residents of Maui County who hold concealed carry permits, along with an organizational plaintiff, sued in federal court. The district court enjoined the law as applied to property open to the public, but the Ninth Circuit reversed that injunction. The questions presented were, first, whether the Ninth Circuit erred in holding, in direct conflict with the Second Circuit, that Hawaii may presumptively prohibit the carry of handguns by licensed concealed carry permit holders on private property, open to the public, unless the property owner affirmatively gives express permission to the handgun carrier. And second, whether the Ninth Circuit erred in solely relying on post-Reconstruction era and later laws in applying Bruin's text, history, and tradition test in direct conflict with the holdings of the Third, Fifth, Eighth, and Eleventh Circuits. The court granted review limited to the first question. The court held, Hawaii's law prohibiting licensed concealed carry permit holders from carrying handguns on private property, open to the public without the property owner's express authorization, violates the Second and Fourteenth Amendments. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett joined. Justice Barrett filed a concurring opinion, in which Justices Thomas and Gorsuch joined as to Part 2B. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Jackson filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Sotomayor joined. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We do our best to remove these and hope they do not impact your listening experience. To leave us feedback on the show, or to learn more about the podcast, please visit so-ordered.org. The following is the opinion of the court in Wolford v. Lopez.
For years, the state of Hawaii made it almost impossible to obtain a license to carry a firearm. 4 years ago, however, this court held in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin decided in 2022 that the Second and Fourteenth Amendments protect the right to carry handguns outside the home for self-defense. Hawaii responded by replacing its old law on carry permits with new laws that achieved a similar result. On a large portion of the land within the state's boundaries, possession of a firearm is now flatly prohibited, and the law now before us severely burdens the ability to carry a firearm in much of the rest of the state by prohibiting firearms on private property without the express and affirmative consent of the property owner. This law departs sharply from the standard common law rule on access to private property held open to the public. Under that rule, everyone, including those lawfully carrying firearms, may enter unless expressly prohibited from doing so. By contrast, under the new Hawaii law, no one carrying a firearm may enter without the property owner's express authorization. The effect of this new rule is to impose severe restrictions on the daily activities of residents who have satisfied the state's rigorous requirements for the issuance of a carry permit. When these permit holders leave home in the morning, not only must they take care to avoid all the territory where the possession of a gun is prohibited outright, but they may also be barred from entering many places that people routinely visit in the course of their daily routines, such as gas stations, convenience stores, restaurants, coffee shops, drug stores, grocery stores, big box stores, home improvement stores, barber shops or hair salons, dry cleaners, and laundromats. This regime hobbles what the Second Amendment protects, the right of Americans to carry arms for self-defense as they go about their daily lives. We hold that the law is unconstitutional. When Hawaii adopted the law now before us, it did so against the backdrop of this court's Second Amendment decisions, and many of the arguments that the state now advances were addressed in those decisions. We therefore begin with an overview of that body of law. The Second Amendment provides a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. For more than two centuries after the ratification of the Second Amendment, this court had few occasions to examine its meaning. Such an occasion arose in District of Columbia v. Heller, decided in 2008. The case was brought by Dick Heller, a resident of the District of Columbia, whose story highlighted the reason why the right to keep and bear arms for self-defense was included in the Bill of Rights. In light of the exceptionally high rate of violent crime in Washington, D.C., Heller wanted to keep a firearm in his home to defend himself in case of a burglary or home invasion. He had all the hallmarks of a citizen who would handle a firearm safely and responsibly. He was a special D.C. police officer who provided security at the Thurgood Marshall Judiciary Building and was authorized under D.C. law to carry a handgun while on duty. But the district, which made it virtually impossible for a resident to keep a handgun at home for self-defense, denied his application for a permit. Unwilling to accept this plight, Heller sued in federal court to vindicate his Second Amendment right. When his case reached this court, we provided our first thorough exploration of the Second Amendment's meaning. We rejected the argument that the Second Amendment right extends only to members of a state militia and held instead that the Second Amendment, like other provisions of the Bill of Rights, protects an individual right enjoyed by the people. Our opinion went on to explain the meaning of the Second Amendment's other key terms. The phrase, to keep and bear arms, we held, signifies what its terms mean in ordinary usage, that is, to have and carry arms. And arms, we explained, refers to implements used for offense or defense. We added that handguns, which are overwhelmingly chosen by American society for self-defense, fall squarely into this category. We also identified the amendment's central concern, securing the fundamental right of self-defense. In late 18th century America, the need for firearms for self-defense was acute. There were no police forces, and most Americans lived in rural areas, often in homes located miles from the closest neighbor. If these homes were attacked, the residents were on their own, and their survival might well depend on the availability of a firearm to ward off assailants. In light of this reality, it is not surprising that the right to keep and bear arms was included among the other treasured liberties protected by the Bill of Rights. But while the founding generation cherished the Second Amendment right, they did not think it was absolute. Heller explained, and later cases have reiterated, that the Second Amendment codified a pre-existing right. And this right, as understood at the time, was not an unlimited right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner and for whatever purpose. Similarly, Heller warned that nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, because the Second Amendment protects a right that already existed when the amendment was adopted. Heller instructed courts to ascertain the scope of the right by looking to history. And, to emphasize the point, Heller emphatically rejected the ahistorical and judge-empowering interest-balancing inquiries suggested in the dissent. Heller acknowledged that the history-based analysis it prescribed would not always be easy, but it found that mode of analysis necessary to prevent judges from balancing away the right that the Second Amendment was adopted to protect, which is precisely what the dissent did. Heller concerned an ordinance adopted by the District of Columbia, and therefore the decision did not govern the states. But since virtually all the provisions of the Bill of Rights had been held to apply equally to the federal government and the states, it was inevitable that the court would have to decide whether the Second Amendment right merited similar treatment. 2 years after Heller, that question came before us in McDonald. The case was brought by residents of Chicago, a city, like Washington, D.C., with a high rate of violent crime. The lead plaintiff, Otis McDonald, was a man in his late 70s who lived in a dangerous neighborhood and had been subjected to violent threats from drug dealers. A city ordinance effectively barred McDonald and the other plaintiffs from possessing guns in their homes for self-defense, and they contended that the fundamental right recognized in Heller should apply throughout the country. The city of Chicago opposed nationwide application of Heller, arguing that law enforcement needs and public attitudes about guns varied from state to state and city to city, and that states and cities should have leeway to regulate gun possession as their lawmakers saw fit. The court, however, disagreed. The plurality opinion, joined by four justices, concluded that the Second Amendment right, like nearly all the rights protected by the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments, should apply equally to the federal government and the states. Following a body of precedent dating back more than a century, the plurality concluded that the provision of the 14th Amendment that did this work was the Due Process Clause. Justice Thomas, who provided the decisive fifth vote, reached a similar result based on the 14th Amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause. But either way, McDonald settled the question whether the Second Amendment embodies a uniform national standard or one that varies from one locale to another. After McDonald, 12 years elapsed before the court's next major Second Amendment decision, Bruin. In the interim, lower courts rejected nearly all Second Amendment claims based on reasoning that resembled that in Justice Breyer's Heller dissent. In Bruin, we considered one such decision, which upheld a New York law that severely restricted the right to carry a handgun outside the home for self-defense. In doing so, we fleshed out the process of historical analysis required in a Second Amendment case. That analysis, we held, involves two steps. First, a court must determine whether the law before it clashes with the plain text of the amendment's language. This inquiry entails three subsidiary questions. First, does the law apply to the people, which is to say, to all members of the political community? Second, does it concern any form of arms, that is, any weapon customarily used for offensive or defensive purposes? Third, does the law place any restrictions on either the keeping, that is, possession, or the bearing, that is, carrying, of arms? If a challenged law falls within the plain text of the Second Amendment, it is presumptively unconstitutional, which means that it may violate the pre-existing right that the amendment codified. But because that right was not in every way coterminous with the amendment's literal language, further analysis may be needed. Specifically, the relevant government, federal, state, or local, may be able to show that its challenged law did not infringe the historical understanding of the codified right. A variety of sources, including scholarship, may aid this inquiry. But often, the best evidence may be what Bruin called historical analogs. These are old legal rules from which a court may draw a strong inference that the modern law at issue is consistent with the codified right. A party defending against a Second Amendment claim may rely on a single analog or a group of analogs. Bruin identified three important inquiries that courts should undertake in evaluating proffered analogs. The first is the number of jurisdictions in which they were adopted. We will not stake our interpretation upon a law in effect in a single state or a single city. The second is the extent to which they were well accepted. This acceptance may be express, as when judicial decisions explicitly acknowledge the rule's legality. Or the acceptance may be tacit, as when a restriction on the keeping or carrying of arms was open, widespread, and unchallenged. The third is whether any analog or collection of analogs is relevantly similar to the modern law. Determining whether this condition is met requires consideration of how the analog restricted the keeping or bearing of arms, that is, whether it imposed a restriction similar to that imposed by the challenged law. And a court must also consider why the analog restricted the keeping or bearing of arms, that is, whether its rationale was similar to that of the new law. In order to be sufficiently similar to the modern law being challenged, a putative analog need not be a dead ringer or historical twin, particularly when the modern law addresses a situation that could not have arisen when the Second or Fourteenth Amendment was adopted. It is too much to demand such a close match. But the how and why of the historical analog and modern regulation must be close enough to enable a court to say, because this historical law was understood to be compatible with the right codified by the Second Amendment, we can infer that the restriction imposed by the modern law is likewise consistent with that right. Making this determination is far more disciplined than the interest-balancing, judge-empowering standard that Heller emphatically rejected. But it is not mechanical. It undeniably necessitates an exercise of judgment. Applying this framework, Bruin held that the challenged New York law, which broadly prohibited law-abiding citizens from carrying commonly used firearms in public for self-defense, violated the Second and Fourteenth Amendments. We found that the state's proffered analogs were critically different from the challenged law, and that the overwhelming weight of historical evidence supported the right of the public to peaceably carry handguns for self-defense. In addition to holding that New York's law violated the Second Amendment, we pointed out that six other jurisdictions had adopted statutory provisions like New York's. One of those jurisdictions was Hawaii. In Bruin, the law at issue concerned conduct that could have occurred when the Second and Fourteenth Amendments were adopted, carrying a handgun outside the home for self-defense. By contrast, in our most recent Second Amendment case, United States v. Rahimi, the law in question, Title 18, United States Code, Section 922G, involved conduct that was distinctively modern. The possession of a firearm by a person against whom a domestic violence restraining order had been issued. Accordingly, application of Step 2 of the Bruin framework called for a more difficult exercise of judgment. In the end, however, the majority was satisfied that the two analogs identified by the federal government, though not dead ringers of Section 922G, were sufficiently similar to support the provision's constitutionality because the challenged regulation was consistent with the principles that underpin our regulatory tradition. The dissent applied the same test but came to the opposite conclusion, exhibiting how Heller's history-based methodology, true to the warning contained in that groundbreaking decision, is not mechanical. With this background in mind, we turn to the Hawaii law challenged in this case. Before Bruin, Hawaii issued firearms carry licenses only in exceptional cases, Indeed, it appears that from 2000 to 2018, only 4 such licenses were issued. After Bruin, Hawaii, and 4 of the other 5 states called out by our decision adopted a new method of restricting law-abiding citizens from carrying firearms for self-defense by flipping the default rule on private property open to the public. At common law, opening up private property to the general public implies a license to all persons to enter, meaning that no person is a trespasser by merely entering therein unless the property owner has given due notice that such a person is banned. After Bruin, Hawaii, and 4 other states singled out in that decision flipped this default rule. Rather than allowing all to enter private property open to the public unless specifically prohibited, these new laws provided that no one carrying a firearm may enter without express authorization. Hawaii's new default rule is part of a tight web of laws that severely restricts the carrying of firearms for self-defense. To start, carrying a handgun for self-defense requires a special license, and obtaining that license is a rigorous process. Applicants must first complete a detailed application that requires the disclosure of medical information. They must then successfully complete an extensive training course in which they demonstrate competency in firearm safety and live fire shooting, as well as an understanding of the law and available mental health resources. And they must demonstrate the essential character or temperament necessary to be entrusted with a firearm. But even for those who fulfill these stringent requirements, Hawaii imposes 2 additional restrictions on carrying firearms. The first bans the possession of a firearm in significant categories of places. Any state-owned building or adjacent grounds and parking areas, any public or private hospital or other place at which medical or health services are customarily provided, any restaurant serving alcohol, any stadium, movie theater, or concert hall, any public library property, any public or private college or university, any public school, charter school, or private school, any beach, playground, or park, any bank or financial institution, any amusement park, aquarium, carnival, circus, fair, museum, water park, or zoo, and any public gathering, public assembly, or special event conducted on property open to the public. Some of these places are owned by the state, but many of the categories include privately owned property. So even if the owner of such a place wanted to admit individuals who are carrying a gun for self-defense, the owner could not do so. The second restriction, the one at issue in this case, generally prohibits licensed individuals from carrying a firearm, even if unloaded or inoperable, on private property of another. Certain categories of individuals, such as police officers, are exempt, but the ban otherwise applies unless express authorization has been given by the owner, lessee, operator, or manager of the property. Such authorization must take one of 2 forms: clear and conspicuous signage that confers such consent, or unambiguous written or verbal authorization to carry a firearm on the premises from the owner, lessee, operator, or manager of the property, or an agent of such a person. Petitioners, 3 residents of Maui County who possess concealed carry permits, and an organizational plaintiff with members who have such permits, contend that these restrictions violate their rights under the United States Constitution, and they filed suit in federal court, seeking both temporary and permanent injunctive relief. The district court declined such relief with respect to private property that is closed to the public, but it enjoined enforcement of the new default rule as applied to private property that is open to the public. A panel of the 9th Circuit reversed that injunction, and the full 9th Circuit denied rehearing en banc. Judge Van Dyke, joined by 5 other judges, issued an opinion dissenting from the denial of rehearing en banc. Judge Collins, joined by Judge Bress, likewise filed a dissent. We granted cert to decide whether Hawaii may prohibit licensed concealed carry permit holders from carrying handguns on private property open to the public unless the property owner gives express permission. As with any Second Amendment challenge, we began by asking whether the restrictions imposed by the challenge law fall within the plain text of the Second Amendment, see Bruin, and we find that this requirement is easily met. No party disputes that petitioners are among the people protected by the Second Amendment, or that they seek to bear, that is, to carry, arms. Therefore, the plain text of the Second Amendment protects what petitioners want to do, carry handguns for self-defense. Petitioners and the United States argue that the new default rule was enacted to undermine our decision in Bruin. But whatever the purpose of the new law, the shift from the old common law rule unquestionably imposed a new and significant burden on the exercise of the right that this court recognized in Bruin. To be sure, owners of establishments that are open to the public can admit or exclude persons who are carrying guns for self-defense under either the common law rule or Hawaii's substitute. As a practical matter, however, the choice between these two default rules is often outcome determinative with respect to Hawaiian's Second Amendment rights. For establishments where the owner either pays no attention or does not care about such issues, the choice of default rule will determine where carry permit holders may lawfully carry firearms. More broadly, Hawaii's new default rule burdens those wishing to exercise their Second Amendment right. Some proprietors who do not themselves object to entry by carry permit holders may be reluctant to post a sign welcoming such individuals for fear of alienating other customers. So under Hawaii's new default rule, a proprietor in this category may only be willing to consent discreetly to the entry of permit holders who make the effort to inquire. This arrangement imposes a new burden on permit holders who will have to somehow obtain permission to carry a firearm on the property before stepping foot on it. To see what Hawaii's new default rule means in practice, consider its impact on a resident of Hawaii whose situation is like that of Jamie Caetano, a young Boston woman who wanted to carry a weapon to defend herself from a violent ex-boyfriend, but was criminally prosecuted when she used a non-lethal weapon to fend him off. Suppose our hypothetical young woman, after clearing all the hurdles needed to get a Hawaiian carry permit, leaves her home on a weekday morning and carries a handgun on her person or in a purse. On the way to work, she intends to fill up her car at a gas station. During her lunch break, she plans to walk to a fast food restaurant and then buy some items at a large drugstore. After work, she wants to pick up clothes at a dry cleaner and then shop for groceries. Unless each of these establishments has posted a sign saying "guns welcome" or something to that effect, each visit could expose her to criminal liability. Imagine what our hypothetical young woman will have to do when she drives to the supermarket after work. When she arrives, she will violate the literal terms of the Hawaii law merely by pulling into the parking lot while having her handgun concealed on her person. She can minimize the length of her violation by disarming as soon as she arrives. But in removing the handgun from her person, she must take care not to let anyone see it for even a moment. Otherwise, she could be charged with recklessly causing alarm to another person by failing to conceal the firearm, even briefly. Once she has removed the handgun from her person, she cannot leave it in her car without locking it in what amounts to a safe. Instead of going through all this, she may choose to remain armed when she enters the supermarket and promptly search for someone who is authorized to provide the consent that the law demands. This will prolong the violation of the terms of the Hawaii law, and finding someone who can provide consent may not be easy. For example, it is most unlikely that the supermarket employee who is gathering up shopping carts in the parking lot or the employee who is restocking shelves will possess that authority. During all the time this search goes on, our hypothetical young woman will be violating the terms of the statute, and if that is brought to the attention of the police, say, by a store employee or customer who hears her ask for permission to enter, she may be charged with a criminal offense or lose her license. And in the end, she may be unable to shop because she cannot find anyone who has been authorized by management to consent. When our hypothetical young woman visits the restaurant at lunch, her situation may be even more difficult. Unless her place of employment has a gun locker where she can store her gun, she may be unable to leave it behind when she leaves the building. And if she disarms before leaving work, she will be vulnerable for that period of time. Even this short period of vulnerability can be deadly. Ms. Citano was approached by her abusive boyfriend right after leaving work. If our hypothetical young woman remains armed during the lunch break, she will violate the terms of the law if she sets foot inside any establishment without a guns welcome sign, even if she immediately seeks someone who can provide authorization to stay. And as was the case with the supermarket, finding such a person may not be easy. Thus, by the end of an ordinary day, our hypothetical young woman could be a criminal at least 6 times over. In short, Hawaii's law severely hampers the ability of a law-abiding citizen to exercise the right Bruin recognized. Hawaii nonetheless argues that petitioner's challenge fails at the first step of Bruin's two-step framework because the right to bear arms did not encompass the right to armed entry onto private property without the owner's consent. The state then launches into a lengthy discussion of historical materials and precedents that, it contends, supports this argument. We will discuss all these authorities, but they are out of place at Bruin's first step. At that stage, as we have explained, the question is simply whether a challenged law falls within the Second Amendment's plain text. We therefore move on to the second step. At this second step, the inquiry mandated by Heller and Bruin turns to an exploration of the historical understanding of the scope of the right the Constitution codified. Hawaii's first argument on this score is based on Hawaii's particular customs and laws. The state starts with the undisputed principle that the owner of private property is generally free to exclude anyone from entering without consent. It acknowledges that an owner's consent need not always be expressed, and that there are circumstances in which consent may be inferred. But the state contends that, whatever the situation in other parts of the country, in Hawaii, opening private property to the public does not implicitly include any armed individuals among those who may enter. In support of this argument, the state recounts its long history of antipathy to the private possession of firearms. It tells us that one of the very first written laws of the Kingdom of Hawaii, issued in 1833 by King Kamehameha III, prohibited the possession of all deadly weapons. Later laws adopted before and after Hawaii became part of the United States continued to heavily restrict the possession and carriage of firearms. And prior to Bruin, Hawaii permitted public carry only in exceptional cases when an applicant showed reason to fear injury to the applicant's person or property. Then, in the wake of Bruin, Hawaii passed the statute at issue in this case, and the state contends that this law continues a Hawaiian tradition and shows that Hawaiians disfavor the carrying of guns in their midst. Accordingly, the state maintains its new default rule merely expresses the circumstances under which implied consent may be reasonably inferred in Hawaii. This argument is little different from the central argument offered by the city of Chicago in McDonald, and Hawaii's version fares no better. As the plurality explained in McDonald, the Second Amendment has the same meaning in all parts of the United States. It cannot give way to the spirit of aloha in Hawaii any more than it can yield to the spirit of the Big Apple or the Windy City. It applies in the same way to our 50th state, where about 8% of adults possess guns, and our 49th state, where the figure is roughly 59%. Merely local attitudes can neither shrink nor inflate the meaning of fundamental Bill of Rights guarantees that apply to the states through the 14th Amendment. When we assess whether a challenge law is consistent with the right, the Second Amendment codified, we seek the general understanding of that codified right at the relevant point in time. An outlier legal rule adopted in a few locales is not enough. See Bruin holding, the language of the Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by reference to the common law and to British institutions as they were when the instrument was framed and adopted. And, as we have explained, overwhelming evidence shows an enduring American tradition permitting public carry. Hawaii's prohibitions on public carry represent a distinct outlier. With this preliminary question out of the way, we turn to Hawaii's main argument that analogous colonial and early state laws support the constitutionality of the state's new law. These old laws, however, are vastly different from Hawaii's new default rule. They consist almost entirely of laws that prohibited unauthorized hunting of deer or small game on someone else's private property. The state's earliest analog is a 1721 Pennsylvania law entitled An Act to Prevent the Killing of Deer Out of Season and Against Carrying of Guns and Hunting by Persons Not Qualified. This statute made it unlawful to carry any gun or hunt on the improved or enclosed lands of any plantation other than his own without securing license or permission from the owner of such lands or plantation. The law's stated purpose was to prevent diverse abuses, damages, and inconveniences that had arisen by persons carrying guns and presuming to hunt on other people's lands. As the Third Circuit observed, that law appears to be primarily focused on preventing Pennsylvanians from hunting on their neighbor's land, not on restricting the right to publicly carry a gun. A 1722 New Jersey statute contains nearly identical language, and a 1728 Maryland statute and a 1763 New York law fall into the same category. The Maryland law, titled An Act to Encourage the Destroying of Wolves, Crows, and Squirrels, made it unlawful to come to hunt with guns or dogs within any enclosed grounds, islands, peninsulas, or necks, fenced across from water to water, without leave or license from the proprietors thereof. And the New York law, titled An Act to Prevent Hunting with Firearms in the City of New York and the Liberties Thereof, made it unlawful to carry, shoot, or discharge any musket, fowling piece, or other firearm whatsoever into, upon, or through any orchard, garden, cornfield, or other enclosed land whatsoever. All these laws targeted unauthorized hunting and focused on land where game could be found. A 1771 New Jersey law followed this tradition, titled An Act for the Preservation of Deer and Other Game, and to prevent trespassing with guns. This law provided that a person could not carry any gun on any lands, not his own, and for which the owner pays taxes, or is in his lawful possession, unless he hath license or permission in writing from the owner or owners or legal possessor. In sum, the state's analogs principally targeted unauthorized hunting. Their coverage differed sharply from that of the Hawaii law now before us. They applied to land where game could be found, not retail establishments that residents of cities and suburbs frequent as part of their daily routines. They had little, if any, impact on the Second Amendment's central objective, protecting the fundamental right to self-defense. And their obvious aim was to prevent the distinctive harms and risks associated with unauthorized hunting. That conduct often entailed the theft of private property. The poacher took game that the property owner might have otherwise harvested. It involved the firing of guns, which created a risk of inadvertently inflicting death or serious injury on the owner of the property, others who were authorized to use the property, and livestock. At a minimum, the sound of the gunshots could surprise, alarm, or disturb the tranquility of others on the property. The conduct restricted by the Hawaii law has none of these effects. Others on the premises will not even notice a person peacefully carrying a concealed weapon in the manner demanded by Hawaiian law. To test whether these analogs are relevantly similar to the challenged Hawaii law, we may ask the question set out earlier. Because it was accepted that prohibiting unauthorized hunting on private land was consistent with the Second Amendment right, can we infer that it is also consistent with that right to ban a person who is lawfully carrying a concealed handgun for self-defense from entering a gas station, coffee shop, grocery store, or other private property open to the public without express and unambiguous consent? The question answers itself. The gap between the state's anti-poaching analogs and its new rule is just too wide. The state's two remaining analogs are even weaker. The first is an 1893 Oregon law that prohibited anyone other than an officer on lawful business from being armed or trespassing upon any enclosed premises or lands without the consent of the owner. On its face, it is not clear that this statute is relevant to the issue before us. For one thing, even if commercial establishments that are open to the public were considered enclosed at the time of the adoption of the Bill of Rights, no Oregon authority shows that the Oregon statute used the term to refer to such establishments. To the contrary, Oregon courts have interpreted the phrase enclosed land as outdoor land surrounded by a visible or distinctive line that demonstrates its separation from contiguous properties, such that a hunter would know to seek permission before hunting. It is thus unlikely that the 1893 Oregon law used the term enclosed to refer to businesses open to the public rather than to private lands on which poaching was a problem. Moreover, the statute does not demand that consent be expressed. But even if this provision is read as Hawaii would have it, a lone statute adopted nearly a century after the adoption of the Second Amendment and well after the adoption of the 14th Amendment sheds little, if any, light on the meaning of the Second Amendment right. Finally, we come to the state's most remarkable analog, an 1865 Louisiana statute that made it unlawful for any person or persons to carry firearms on the premises or plantations of any citizen without the consent of the owner or proprietor other than in lawful discharge of a civil or military order. Regardless of this provision's pedigree, it has no probative value for present purposes. As we have said, in considering the probative value of a historical analog, we must consider whether it was widespread, well-known, and widely accepted. Because this statute was neither widespread nor widely accepted, it carries no weight. We could stop there, but there is another reason for rejecting Hawaii's reliance on this statute. It was adopted by the Louisiana legislature between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of Reconstruction. When the war ended, the legislatures in defeated Confederate states quickly enacted so-called black codes that aimed to perpetuate the subjugation of blacks. The statute Hawaii cites was part of Louisiana's black code, and it provided a tool for disarming blacks and thus leaving them defenseless against attacks. As we laid out in McDonald, the right to keep and bear arms was crucially important for vulnerable blacks during this period. And this was well understood by the Republicans in Congress who were responsible for drafting, approving, and securing the ratification of the 14th Amendment. The Republican Party platforms of 1856 and 1860 called for protection of the right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. Unless we put history entirely out of our minds, Hawaii's claim that this tainted artifact illuminates the original understanding of the right to keep and bear arms cannot be taken seriously. The Hawaii law at issue here violates the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. Therefore, the judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered